This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the opt-out movement grows as parents and students fight back against excessive standardized testing. Broken windows policing is still the rule in New York City. And President Obama talks peace with Cuba while making war against Venezuela. But first, a national poll commissioned by In the Public Interest has found broad support for reining in the spread of charter schools and for making them conform to the same standards as traditional public schools. The poll also shows majorities oppose an overemphasis on standardized testing in the classroom. David Cohen, executive director of In the Public Interest, said the survey shows Americans continue to have a high regard for public schools and for public school teachers, despite the propaganda put out by school privatizers.
That's exactly right. You know, most children are in public schools, the vast majority. Most, when you know, this is not just our poll, but overwhelmingly when parents are asked, how do you feel about your teacher and your public and your neighborhood school? You know, there's real support there. Not to say that there aren't issues and schools that need to be made better. And occasionally there's a teacher that someone doesn't like or isn't doing a good job. But what's really going on, in our view, is that there is a wholesale assault going on the fundamental public good of public education and the public systems of public education by folks that would, in earlier iterations, you know, wanted to pass school voucher initiatives around the country, but those failed by and large. So now they are trying to grow privately operated charter schools that are unregulated and fundamentally unaccountable. And, you know, and you've got folks like the Walton Foundation and, you know, the Walmart family has poured in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, other billionaires, other folks in who run hedge funds that have decided that the best way to make government dollars something that they can get their hands on and make their political opponents weaker is to grow as many charters as possible. And part of what you have to do is you have to have an ongoing campaign to convince the American public that schools are bad. That's really what's going on in America. And it's not what we need. What we need is, you know, schools need to improve. These are public institutions where every kid ought to get educated in the best possible way. So schools that aren't performing as well, we should do everything we can to make them better. We should solve the problems that cause schools to have difficulty, like poverty and racism and segregation and other things like that. And so that's what we need to do. And, you know, if the conservatives and the billionaires that want to create another school system really cared about public education, they'd be putting their money towards our schools, towards every school.
We should note historically that vouchers for private schools was an initiative of mainly Republicans, yet the Democratic Party has largely embraced charter schools.
Yeah, they don't really know charter schools. People believe charter schools are good. That's what charter means to them, because it's something new. There are good charter schools. There are bad charter schools. There's a lot more ignorance about charter schools than there is knowledge about charter schools. The one thing I'll point you to is when we asked in general, you know, what people believed were their biggest concerns about schools in their community and around the country, we found that the top concern was too much focus on standardized testing. The second most important concern was too many cuts in funding to programs like arts and music and PE and other things that make education well-rounded. And significantly, the least significant issue to folks was the lack of school choice. And the pro-charter growth movement, as it were, claims that that's the biggest issue, that everybody wants more choice. And that's not accurate. They want better schools. They want good schools for their children. We want good schools for their community.
Well, possibly one of the reasons that so many people are ignorant of charter schools is because there are very few charter schools in the white community, and the focus has been parachuting them into the black community.
Yeah, well, in fact, you know, urban school districts, you know, Chicago and Los Angeles and New York, I mean, that's, you know, the charter industry claiming to be about helping poor children, helping black children and children of color and solving inequality are targeting urban districts because there's frustration with the school district. There is enough density to have a market impact. So, you know, it's actually the suburban areas that are whiter and, you know, and more middle income that have fewer charters, actually. So this is a very, you know, this is a wholesale assault on urban school districts, but not exclusively, but it's, you know, they make it a lot of ground. New Orleans, as you probably know, is, you know, after, you know, they took advantage of Hurricane Katrina to go all charter afterwards. And, you know, one of the outcomes has been a number of projects that have researched the impacts of the full charterization. And, you know, one of the key impacts that we see over and over again are these high-density charter areas, you know, it's resegregating the school system. You know, New Orleans is now a multi-tier system, not just on race, but on race and class and other places. And so there's really good schools, there's medium schools, and there's not-so-good schools, where you have systems that are now good for some, but not for all. And that's fundamentally damaging to democracy and the concept of public education and what we need to do for the future.
There has, however, been a major pushback in white communities against standardized testing. And
yes.
Your survey has shown that standardized testing is not popular among parents.
Yeah, that's true. And we, you know, we did polling last year, similar polling last year, and have, on that particular issue, we have found increasing discomfort with this, you know, over-testing. It's definitely a trend, and it's coming from all sides. It's coming from the, you know, the far right that doesn't want big government involved in their school system and thinks it's Obama's, you know, it's like Obamacare for them. It's anything Obama's bad. There's, you know, just people who are seeing what's going on for their kids. It's really from all sides. It's just gone way too far, this, you know, this push for metrics and testing. While we need to know where we are, we need to hold systems accountable and all that, you know, it's gone so far, it's absolutely getting in the way of education. There's no question about that.
The demand for accountability in the public schools, including the charter schools, seems to weigh heavily among those who were surveyed.
Yeah, well, we tested for that specifically. That, you know, it was a poll, it was a survey to test. Because charters have grown very rapidly, and I can't think of the numbers off the top of my head, but they've grown very rapidly over the last 10 years. I mean, it's been a big push by the pro-charter folks is to grow fast. We look at the investor community on this, where, and I remember seeing a quote sometime in the last couple of months that said, the key growth strategy for charter chains and charters is to grow fast and worry about quality later. Because they know if they, once they get in, they're not getting, you know, they're not being pushed out. So there's been enormous growth. It's been their strategy to grow them fast. They put out the message and the idea that charters are less regulated, which means they can innovate more and they're not tied down by bureaucratic rules. The problem with that is that there's no rules and there's very little regulation. So there's no transparency, there's no accountability. There's very limited controls that elected school boards have over charter schools right now of basic things. School quality, whether finances are being spent well and appropriately. We have ability to find fraud. You know, this is all public money. So we specifically wanted to test some of these ideas on how to make charters more accountable. We don't think we're getting rid of them. We just, they all need to be good, every school, charter or not. And we found shocking support, you know, in terms of incredibly high level of support. You know, such some basic common sense, you know, accountability and transparency and standards for schools, stuff that should be a no-brainer.
Your survey shows a high level of concern among parents for their children to have highly qualified teachers. But with charter schools, that seems to go hand in hand with a lowering of teacher standards and an influx of novice teachers from places like Teach for America.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of nonprofit charters. Within that, there are a bunch of for-profit charter management organizations. And one of their claims, you know, is that they'll do more with less. You know, they'll be more efficient, whatever that means. And the only way you make schools more efficient is you spend less money, meaning, you know, lower pay for teachers. So younger teachers are cheaper. You give less benefits and salary. So make it less of a potential for a good, solid, good career with a decent standard of living. Or you could educate more kids with less, meaning the class sizes can go larger. You can do more, what they call blended learning. In other words, more online learning. So that's what they mean when they say efficiency. They want to just, you know, they'll do better because they can be more efficient, but it means spending less money. And you spend less money in a classroom, you get less quality.
One of the high priorities or aspirational high priorities of those surveyed was for what you call community schools or community schools concept. That is, schools that provide health and social services and services to youth and services to parents as well. But with charter schools, we find less community involvement and certainly no involvement of public institutions like school boards.
In terms of school boards, the board of the school, they're the governing body. Their meetings don't have to be open. Their finances don't have to be completely, you know, transparent and, you know, all of that. And so you absolutely have less ability to be involved. You live in New Jersey. I'm sure you've seen these articles in the New York Times about Eva Moskowitz's Success Academy. I found fascinating is that when the New York Times found this video of a teacher berating a student, you know, in this private charter school, ripping up her work and, you know, just really awful teaching methods. The video was made public. The parent ultimately pulled her kid out and put her daughter back in a public school. But when she went to the Department of Education in New York to file a complaint against sort of abusive teaching, she was told that they can't do anything about it. The board is an independent body. You know, the school is independent. And she would have to go to the school's trustees. And if you look at who the school's trustees are, the board, it's, you know, these are, you know, it's mostly hedge fund leaders and investors and public relations people and lawyers. You know, that's how she would have had to go to. But there's no recourse other than litigation. There's sort of like formal public recourse like you would have at a public school district. You know, it's just not right.
Yes, I do live in New Jersey, and almost all of the majority black and brown cities in the state have been targeted by the charter school industry, and the biggest cities have been taken over by the state. That is, their public school systems don't have any local control. And the state takeovers seem to go hand in hand with an influx of charter schools.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. It's exactly right. They think, you know, I mean, New Jersey, right? Chris Christie wants to, he's a pro-charter guy because he figures he can get rid of the teachers union, the, you know, New Jersey Education Association. He figures he can give it to some of his cronies. It's privatization, right? They like privatization. Take it out of the government. Give it to folks that they, you know, that they know. And so when you have school districts in distress like Newark, this is the silver bullet in their mind, but it's just a takeover. That's all it is. The 30,000-foot level and the more fundamental level really is, it's an assault on our responsibility as a public. We need every school to be great, and we need to realize that you can't solve all of society's problems through schools. You have to solve society's problems through a broad array of things. People need health care. They need child care. They need good jobs. And you can't separate that from education. It's the most fundamental thing we do. If parents can't help their kids with homework, that hurts. If parents aren't around because they're working two jobs, that hurts. All these things actually affect schools, and so just making them private isn't going to help.
President Obama's Race to the Top program has been used as a weapon to beat states into accepting higher levels of charter schools or lose federal money. That has been the effect.
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. The administration's putting a lot of money into growth of charter. They think that's part of the answer. And again, it really, we're creating parallel systems, which are weakening in dramatic ways our public systems, financially, socially, in every which way. So I think they've been on the wrong, the administration has been on the wrong track here.
What is the potential of the opt-out movement, that is, the movement to allow parents and students to opt out of these standardized tests. What's the possibility of that movement aligning with the anti-charter movement to create a bigger resistance to this intrusion on the public schools?
I don't know exactly. We work with a number of, you know, organizations around the country that are organizing in communities, but, you know, we're not directly doing organizing communities. And there's a national network called AROS, A-R-O-S, Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools, and they have a website. And I know as they've been organizing in communities around the country that it actually, they are unifying those issues. It's, you know, the school closures. It's, you know, like they did in Chicago. It's over-testing, like you mentioned. It's charter accountability. So it seems from the grassroots, and not just what they're against and what they're for, the growth of community schools, as you mentioned, you know, because, you know, we're about good education. We're about creating a public goods in this fashion. So these grassroots groups around the country are doing just that. And you know, this is their agenda. Great community schools, more funding, reduce over-testing and teaching to the test, increase charter accountability, and make our public schools whole and successful.
And back to the larger issue, and at the top of your survey, the strong support that the public gives to the public schools and to school teachers, the drive for vouchers for private schools was designed to drive a wedge between largely Democratic voters in urban areas and teachers' unions. And both of these were pillars of the Democratic Party. Do you think that they have succeeded with not just private school vouchers, but with the charter movement?
I think they have succeeded to some extent. Yes, absolutely. Urban schools have issues that they need to work through. There are different stakeholders, as you know. There are teachers who go to work every day and want to educate their kids. I've never met a teacher who doesn't want to do that, is not completely committed to that. But they also have jobs, and they need protections and on the job. And then there are parents and students and others in the community. And the conservatives and the right wing in America, the political right wing in America, has seen clearly that as part of their effort to move America to the right, they have to weaken their political opponents, which are, you know, organizations like the NEA and the AFT and others that are pro-public education. They have to split, just like as you say, they have to create divisions within constituencies that fundamentally have similar interests, working people and communities of color and black and brown communities that all suffer from sort of growing inequality and growing corporate control of the country. And so they have made some headway. And I think, you know, what we're seeing now is we're starting to see progressives and teachers' unions and communities are starting to realize that that's what's going on with this sort of massive privatization of the schools. And there's good work happening now to try to counteract that.
Donald Cohen of In the Public Interest. Parents, teachers, and activists gathered recently in Philadelphia for a national conference of the opt-out movement, which seeks to end excessive standardized testing in the public schools. We spoke with Dr. Denisha Jones, a board member of United Opt Out and an assistant professor of early childhood education at Washington, D.C.'s Howard University. The organization demands an equitably funded, democratically based, anti-racist, desegregated public school system for all Americans, one that prepares students to exercise compassionate and critical decision-making. Dr. Jones says none of this can happen if kids are spending all their time taking tests.
We know opt-outs are growing, especially in places like New York State, but they tend to still be predominantly white middle-class communities. So one of the things we're looking to do is help develop opt-out movements and help support opt-out movements in black and brown communities. And so that was one of the reasons why we went to Philadelphia. They've been working hard. Lots of parents have been kind of opting out, and we wanted to bring our conference to them.
Why do you think it is that the opt-out movement would be so centered, as it has been, in white communities when it's become quite clear that the standardized testing regime is related to the effort to privatize and turn into charters urban school districts, and yet the reaction is coming from white suburban families largely?
Well, I think one of the things with standardized testing is that it does affect all families. And so school closings and other things tend to affect urban families differently. But what we saw with the new Common Core standards and the new testing Park and Smarter Balance, was that it had a broad effect against all families. And so we saw white middle-class families get affected because this affected them. And so they generally spoke out. We also think there's a big dynamic to play about who can opt out, and is opt out a good choice? And so we tend to see that a lot of white middle-class families have more of the social capital resources needed to opt out. They know how to where to go for help. They know how to network with other families, and they don't get as much resistance. They get some resistance, but not as much as I've heard from Black parents who tell the schools they're going to opt out. I think there's also some feelings in the Black community that we need these tests. We have civil rights groups who claim that we need high-stakes standardized testing to hold schools accountable for racial disparities in education. And so if you read something like that, you're more or less likely to think that opting out is a really good answer for Black parents. And so I think that's some of the historical reasons why. And then, you know, a couple years ago, Arnie Duncan said, when he was still Secretary of Education, that the opt-out movement was all white suburban moms who were finding out that their children are not as smart as they thought they were. And that was really intentional to put a divide in the movement by stating it that way. And so that's it was his way to kind of attack the movement. But we know opt-out is not only white suburban moms. There have been African-American parents for 20 years now who've opted out. One of the co-founders, one of the original founding members of United Opt Out, Teresa Smith, is an African-American mom, and she opted her daughter out of testing in Florida years ago. Her daughter is now a junior at Howard University. So she graduated without taking any of the required tests in Florida. So we've seen opting out happening a lot, but I think with the push of the Common Core standards, it just blew up, especially in the white middle-class communities, and they've had greater resources to make the story heard from their perspective.
Are you pleased with the growth of the opt-out movement in both the white and the non-white communities?
Yes, we are, and we'd like to see it grow. I mean, we're very happy to hear the estimates are about 600,000 students might have opted out last year across the country, which is great. There's still a lot of room to grow. And we know that, you know, in Philadelphia, we had three African-American parents on a panel who talked about the movement in Philadelphia. We know that in New York City, some of the low-income schools that have more Black and brown parents are opting out. So we know that it's changing. But as a whole, yes, opting out continues to grow. And we are pleased that this tactic is working to help kind of push back against the corporate reform movement in education.
And what has the stance been of the teachers' unions, which have endorsed President Obama and now Hillary Clinton, despite their positions on both charters and standardized testing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been to a few events where I was at the Network for Public Education Conference in Chicago last year, and both Lily Eskelin, the president of the National Education Association, and Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, were there. And, you know, at some point, they both speak about supporting a parent's right to opt out. But we hear different language coming down from union officials. In Florida, a union president sent out an email telling teachers that they are not allowed to mention opt-out, and if they do, it'll cost them their jobs. So we're hearing very different information. I was on the Kojo Nandi show, and Randy Weingarten called in as a guest, and she did say that she supported opt-out and parents' right to opt-out, but that doesn't necessarily translate to teachers having the right to inform parents about opting out and to let parents know. And that really depends on what state you work in and how your district is managed, because in some states, in Pennsylvania, your teachers are allowed, because there's an opt-out clause, teachers are allowed to speak out and opt out a little bit more. But in some districts, teachers can't say a thing. They're in a right-to-work state, and it'll cost them their jobs. So we think the unions need to come out stronger on the side of protecting teachers who talk about opting out and inform parents of their right to opt out.
So it seems that the opt-out movement faces a kind of internal struggle at two levels, one within the union itself or with the union hierarchy, and the other internally within the Black community.
Yeah, I mean, the opt-out movement is not owned by any one particular group. United Opt-Out National started a couple, 24 years ago, but we have local state groups who do opting out work. And so we don't pretend to own the opt-out movement. And there's a lot of diverse people in the movement. There are some very conservative families who are pushing opt-out as a rebuke of President Obama and Obama's policies. And they're only really in it because of that reason. And so not everyone is in it for the same reasons we are for the opt-out movement. So it's a very diverse movement, but United Opt Out is more of a progressive radical movement who sees opt out as just a tactic to bring down corporate education reform, a strategy that we can build upon. But it's not the end game for us. Testing is a problem, but there's so much more a problem. And so I think when you look at people and you see where they are they just concerned about the testing, then they're on one side of the opt out movement. But if they're concerned about testing and charters and school closures and privatization schemes and Teach for America and competency based education, then they're on a different side of the opt out scheme.
I looked up Bernie Sanders' position on both opt-out and standardized testing. There's not been much talk of that in the campaign, but in the questionnaire, he outlined his position, and it seemed to be a near-perfect match with the opt-out movement.
Yeah, we are hoping to hear more about Bernie Sanders' position. We know Hillary Clinton is in favor of charters. We haven't really heard her position on opt-out. It would be nice if Senator Sanders came out in favor of parents' right to opt out, and that's something we hope to hear from them in the future. I know there's been some, it's not been publicly stated, and that's because education has not been spoke of in the campaigns. We've heard them talk about college and universal pre-K, and that's it. They don't really talk about elementary school, high school, and testing and that sort of thing. It would be nice to have, but again, opting out, we're not looking for an okay for opting out. Opting out is an act of civil disobedience, right? When parents email me and say, I'm asking to opt out, my teacher's saying no, my school's saying no, you're not asking anyone anything. You're not asking for permission. You're informing them of a choice you made for your child, and you're asking them what are the commendations when your child shows up on test day. And so we want people to remember that this is an act of civil disobedience. We don't need legislation to approve it. We don't need anyone else to approve it. We need to say that we are opting out as an act of civil disobedience to protect public education from the corporatization and the testing.
And in some localities, there are penalties, and in others, less so.
We have been told that school districts will lose money. So that's been the big mantra from the Federal Department of Education, that districts that have less than 95% of students who take standardized tests will lose funding. To date, no school district has lost funding. And so as we look at this new Every Student Succeeds Act bill and how in it, on one hand, it says you need 95% of students to take testing. But on the other hand, it says we won't hold school districts accountable for not meeting that 95. It doesn't really give a clear answer on where the states are going to go. We believe that although they're threatening to withhold money, that they won't. And if they do, that's a challenge we're willing to take on through the legal system, because it makes no sense to deny school district funding because of a choice parents and students made.
And if enough parents opt out, the administration would be playing a kind of game of chicken.
Yeah, well, our goal is if you're in a classroom and no one's taking the test, then there's no need for test prep. You can get back to real teaching and learning. And if no one in the school is taking the test, then there's no need to spend 6 to 8 weeks of instruction time on a test. You can get back to real teaching and learning. So, and we know that happens. We know in Seattle, when the teachers refuse to administer the test for the entire school of Garfield High School, that it can happen. And so that's what we'd like to see. Opting out is hard in isolation. It's hard for one child or two children to opt out. It doesn't change anything. But when classrooms and schools opt out, it's a game changer. We can get out underneath this testing obsession and get back to what we do best, which is teach young children.
So you've got to reach a critical mass at various schools so that the students aren't isolated.
Yes, that's ideally what we would like to see, is that when we talk to teachers and parents, getting groups together so you're not the only one is really helpful, so that they can see that there's no need for any of this testing or preparation to happen if no one's going to take the test.
Dr. Denisha Jones, speaking from Washington. Robert Ganji, executive director of the Police Reform Organizing Project in New York, has been busy monitoring courtroom activity around the city. Ganji reports that the courts are busy prosecuting black and brown men on minor offenses, an indication that the broken windows philosophy of policing is alive and well in New York City.
Yeah, and continuing to inflict harm and hardship on primarily New Yorkers of color and primarily low-income New Yorkers of color who have insufficient resources generally and insufficient political standing to protect themselves against the abusive and discriminatory police practices represented by broken windows tactics in New York City. We were just in Manhattan, Raymond Park today, and we saw 21 cases, 19 of which involved people of color. Wednesday, we saw about 30 cases, arraignments. There was one white person. Everybody else was a person of color. So these practices continue to represent a blatantly racist form of policing. And everybody that we saw, it would be a stretch of the imagination to think of them as dangerous or predatory people. Some of them clearly had either mental health issues or drug or alcohol addiction issues. Some of them were homeless or nearly homeless. The charges involved, generally speaking, minor things. Could be a suspended license, could be begging on the subway. We saw a couple of cases involving trespass. And when we spoke to the people who had been charged with trespass and even pled guilty to it, they were visiting friends. Or there was one case where a man was standing in the lobby of his wife's cousin building, and the cousin had just had a baby, and he was meeting her in the lobby to give her money so she could go out and buy formula for her child. And the cops came in and spoke rudely to the guy. He asked him why he was standing there and asked him for his ID, and they ended up arresting him and charging him with trespass. And these kind of harassment tactics are not aberrational. They occur on a regular basis in New York City. It's a function of broken windows policing, and it's also a function of the quota system. Police officers are evaluated primarily on the basis of punitive interactions they have with New Yorkers. That's arrests, stops, summonses. And if the officers don't make their numbers in a given month, say, the NYPD will sanction them in one way or another.
And those quotas are not in effect in mostly white areas of New York.
Our understanding from talking to police officers and also observing and having an understanding of how the police operates and who they arrest and what they charge them with is that is, in fact, true, that in some precincts there are no quotas. And in precincts that, quote unquote, serve low-income communities of color, there are quotas. We heard from one police officer who was willing to talk to us that when an officer is a newbie and he or she gets assigned for the first time to an inner city precinct, one of their first questions when they get to the precinct is, what's their number?
And what's their number means how many
summonses? Means how many arrests, summonses, stops do they have to make to hit the number that's expected of them so that they can get a positive evaluation.
Yes, in your piece, you talk about officers sometimes leaving so-called hotspots, that is, places where
right.
they know they can get arrests if they want
right.
to, leaving them alone early in the month so that they can make up their quota numbers at the end of the month by just going to the hotspot and giving
right.
everybody a summons or arrest.
Right, or making an arrest, right. And so, in effect, the quota system in that instance contributes to the prevalence of crime. That police officers, because of the quota system, have an incentive to let crime thrive in certain areas of the community so that they always have a kind of fallback if they come at the end of the month and they haven't made their numbers. What we've also heard about from several officers is a practice called cemetery summonses, where officers, again, if they come into the end of the month and they don't have sufficient numbers of notches on their belt, they will go into the cemetery that's in their precinct and write out summonses to the names of the dead people that they see on the tombstones. So there are many ill effects of the summons and arrest quotas, and it's a very corrupt process. But the ultimate damage it does is provide incentives for police officers to target and harass low-income people of color.
You talk about an instance in which community members expressed a concern about an armed robbery in their neighborhood. They asked the cops what they were going to do about it, and one of the white shirts, I guess, said, well, we're summonsing like crazy, meaning giving out plenty of tickets.
Right. What that story reflected, in my mind, is that the police department and high-level police officers really believe that that's an effective crime-fighting strategy. To give out and intensify the practice of giving out more summonses if there's a particular crime problem in the community, as if that's going to somehow enable you to catch the perpetrators of serious crime. And they think there's a certain kind of magic that will take place if they engage in that kind of law enforcement strategy. But what it shows up, though, and what it exposes is that too much of the NYPD resources is devoted to sanctioning, arresting, ticketing low-level infractions. They're not even legally considered crimes. And that the department doesn't have sufficient ability in terms of their skilled personnel to investigate crimes. The NYPD, for the most part, is not engaged in the kind of activity that you see cops do on television police shows. You don't see on TV cop shows police officers arresting people because they're walking the dog in the park after dark, or because people have their foot up on the subway seat at 2:30 in the morning, or because people are drinking a beer on their stoop while listening to the radio. And that's a lot. We're not overstating this. That is a lot of what police officers do in New York City. And there is a legitimate function for police, and that is to investigate serious offenses, offenses that hurt people, offenses that threaten the well-being of a community, and to investigate those kind of offenses and to dedicate themselves to bringing the perpetrators of those offenses to justice. And again, that's what we see on the TV shows, but they're relatively small percentage of the police personnel in the NYPD who performs that function.
And so when New York City gets an additional 1,000 cops, all that may mean is
right.
Tens and tens and tens of thousands of more summonses.
It could translate into that in very specific terms and in general terms, a greater, a more intrusive and oppressive police presence in low-income communities of color.
All the while, the police department, its high officials claim there is no such thing as quotas. Does
right.
Mayor de Blasio's administration continue to go along
yes.
with that
yeah.
fiction?
De Blasio is in, unfortunately, complete lockstep with Commissioner of the NYPD, Bill Bratton. And, you know, when people point out to me that Bill Bratton and de Blasio claim there are no quotas, my response is, Bill Clinton said he did not have sex with that woman, and George Bush said that the United States was not torture. Well, we know that politicians distort the truth and for political purposes and cover up the truth or lie for political purposes. And that's what's going on in New York City today in regard to quotas.
But I heard a couple of months ago that Mayor de Blasio was down to 23% support among white New Yorkers, presumably because they don't think he's hard enough on crime.
Yeah, it's hard to know why his poll numbers are so poor amongst white people. He supports, you know, Bill Bratton's police department in all their tactics and all their practices, including quota-driven broken windows policing. And his support for those kind of practices just completely undermines his claim to be a progressive political leader, and that the main purpose of his administration is to successfully address social and racial and economic inequities. Because broken windows policing, driven by the quota system, is a central factor in creating those very social and racial inequities that de Blasio claims to address. And until we have equal justice, you know, equal justice is supposed to be an operating principle of the institutions in New York and in our country. And the notion of equal justice is a travesty in the experience of most low-income people of color. And we don't have anything approaching a system of equal justice in our country. And in some ways, our goal at PROP and the goal of other criminal justice and police reformers is to connect America in a very real way with those ideals. So it will no longer be a lie when people representing our country and our city and our state make the claim that we apply equal justice to all people.
That was Robert Ganji of New York City's Police Reform Organizing Project. Earlier this month, a death squad assassinated Honduran indigenous peoples leader Berta Cáceres. Cáceres was at the top of the list for the Honduran regime that was installed in a U.S.-backed coup in 2009. She fought countless battles against land grabs by multinational corporations. Her friend, Beverly Bell, a co-founder of the group Other Worlds, says the regime and its backers in Washington killed Berta Cáceres.
There is not any doubt as to who killed Berta Cáceres. She has received more death threats from the government of Honduras than anyone could possibly count. I was just looking at a list yesterday. She received something like 7 threats in the last month, very direct threats from members of the government. They have wanted her dead for a long time. And those who actually did the job were 2 death squads. Death squad folks, there is lots of information on what the car was that they traveled in. There is one witness who saw the whole thing. It's very, very obvious who killed Berta Cáceres, although the government of Honduras is trying very hard to pin the death of this hero on the members of her own organization and thereby try to get rid of even more of them than the leader that they just tragically assassinated.
Death squads are very active in Honduras. It has one of the highest levels of political assassination in the world, and especially since the 2009 coup, which was backed by the United States.
That's right. The United States government's blood is all over the death of Berta Cáceres. Just to give you a little background, Glenn, about that coup d'etat, in case your listeners don't know, there was an elected president, Manuel Zelaya, and he was not a progressive by any means, but he was open to the calls of indigenous and popular organizations for 2 things, notably. One was for land reform, because, as you might imagine, Honduras has an extremely high level of land and wealth concentration. And the second was for what Berta and others called the refounding of the country. And that is to say that the so-called democracy has not existed for quite some time, if ever, probably never in Honduras. And so Berta and the group that she headed and founded, the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, or COPIN for short, was at the forefront of an effort to hold a national convention to consider amending the constitution or redrafting a constitution. President Zelaya was open to both of those things. He was entertaining some of the proposals for land reform coming for the bases from the grassroots, from Berta's organization and others, and also was open to discussing an assembly, a national assembly, to discuss whether or not to amend the Constitution. And these were the 2 proximate causes for the coup d'etat. I will mention that Hillary Clinton herself was deeply, deeply involved in that coup. If you track her statements over the course of 2 months, it's really quite amazing. She started off the day after the coup calling it a coup d'etat. She used those 2 words. And over the course of the next 2 months, as the U.S. took control of the country, she began backtracking to ultimately saying that the situation was, quote, murky. She even bragged of her role in the coup in the last book that she wrote. Certainly, the U.S.'s role was not limited to Hillary Clinton. The U.S. does give direct military assistance to Honduras, even though they are not at war against anyone except their own people. Last year, they gave $5.5 million in military assistance. And I do believe, Glenn, that our taxpayers are involved in the death of, our taxpayer dollars, rather, are involved in the death of Berta Cáceres. Moreover, many of the military leaders who have been engaged in attacking grassroots organizations like Berta's were trained at the School of the Americas. So, yes, the U.S. is all over this, and what has happened since the coup against President Zelaya in 2009 is that there have been a series of sham elections which have allowed the U.S. and the Honduran elite to keep their people in power completely illegitimately.
And what has the assassination of Ms. Cáceres, what kind of impact has that had on the organizations and peoples that she represented?
My goodness, the whole state of Honduras is in national mourning, the whole country of Honduras. Someone showed me last night pictures from Tegucigalpa, the capital. There are murals of Berta Cáceres that have sprung up everywhere throughout the capital. There were 5,000 people who turned out at her funeral on last Saturday. The calls for justice, there is no possible justice for Berta. She's dead now. But the response has just come from everywhere, not only throughout Honduras, but also throughout the world, because Berta was not only an indigenous leader and a woman's leader and a grassroots leader from Honduras, she was also a very powerful global social movement leader. So the ramifications of her death are huge, and she was not an isolated leader. She did have a large, large group of people who worked with her. The organization that she ran, COPIN, is comprised of hundreds and hundreds of indigenous and small farmer communities, and they will take this struggle on. But certainly her leadership in Honduras was unparalleled as a voice for justice and democracy and rights for all, especially the most excluded. And her voice and her presence and her leadership and her integrity will be sorely missed. There is no way to overstate the impact of this loss.
You seem to be saying that despite these years of government oppression and the latest assassination of Ms. Cáceres, it's not driving the resistance underground.
No, it has not. It's very active. However, there is tremendous fear of an even harsher government crackdown. Even immediately since Berta's assassination, one member of her own organization, the number two leader there, was arrested and held in jail for 3 days, quote, upon suspicion of his engagement in her murder as a crime of passion. I mean, just ridiculously naked, transparent lies. But the government is going to use this opportunity now, we are sure, to crack down even further on popular organizations in Honduras. And they will try to hold out as much as they can. And yet, as you mentioned, Honduras is a country of extraordinary repression and very regular levels of assassination. And we expect a tremendous amount of violence against grassroots movements there.
And what kind of noises has the United States and its embassy been making, if any, in light of the latest assassination?
It was really quite sickening to witness that right after Berta was killed, the United States government came out with a statement lamenting her death and calling for justice and finding the killers. The government of Honduras did the same thing, as even did the dam company that Berta and Copin had been working so hard to fight, which dam company had been involved in shooting, killing, torturing, kidnapping, and disappearing other members of COPIN and trying to do the same to Berta herself. They even came out with a statement of condolence. So we know that the U.S. is in close conversation with the Honduran government, and there are certainly joint efforts underway. We already know we've received some of the, you know, the cable traffic. There are efforts underway to cover up those responsible for this murder and to use this as a way to further disempower the resistance, because the resistance movement is focused primarily on the Honduran government, but also very much on the role of the U.S. government and of transnational capital, because so much of the fight of COPIN has been against the dams that are planned for indigenous lands, the mining operations that are being put illegally on indigenous lands, the forestry concessions that have been given to log timber on indigenous lands. And so COPIN is very, very clear. This is not just a fight for human rights, but this is a fight over who controls power and the incredibly destructive role of transnational capitalism in Honduras.
Could you describe, in general, COPINA, that is Ms. Cáceres' organization's, their vision for democracy in Honduras?
Yes, their vision is extraordinary, Glenn. It is just one of the deepest and most thorough visions that I have encountered in social movements anywhere. They understand that a few reforms are not going to change the situation. They understand that one dam leaving indigenous lands, indigenous sacred waters, is not going to change the situation. They know that the only way there will be any justice for Berta's death and for the death of so many other members of their organization and similar organizations in Honduras is for there to be a true transformation politically and economically in that country, where power is not held by a few elites with the gross intervention of the United States government, which incidentally has 6 military bases in Honduras and has used Honduras as its launching pad for decades now for its control of all of Central America. They also know that as long as a small elite continues to dominate government and society, that nothing will change deeply. So they are firmly committed to a whole new country, a whole new form of government, not just government, but governance, that can really open up space for the input of everyone in what happens in the country and for everyone benefiting from the riches and the benefits thereof.
Which might explain why the United States was in favor of that coup in 2009.
Absolutely. I think that they felt that the masses had gotten too uppity. The fact is there was a lot of organizing, and it was very profound, as I just mentioned, in its vision of real and very deep-reaching transformation, and the U.S. doesn't tolerate that in its client states, and it has long viewed Honduras as one of its client states. So Hillary Clinton and the whole U.S. government had a lot to gain by trying to thwart this movement from growing any further, and they have killed a lot of people in the process of trying to stop this movement.
And in the immediate term and the long term, what can people here in the United States do to show their solidarity with the people of Honduras?
Well, for one thing, they can be in touch with the U.S. ambassador in Honduras, and they can find that email address and phone number on our website, which is otherworldsarepossible.org. Again, that's otherworldsarepossible.org. And they can be in touch with the U.S. government and the Honduran government to call for an independent international investigation of Berta's murder and to ask that that be led by the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights instead of keeping it under the Honduran government, where, as I mentioned, the investigation is already being really closely manipulated. And your listeners can find the email addresses that they need in order to reach out and take this critical action on the website of my organization, and that is otherworldsarepossible.org. Again, that's otherworldsarepossible.org.
That was social activist Beverly Bell. President Obama will visit Cuba later this month. The president claims his trip is designed to further normalization of relations and peace in the region. But political analyst Eric Dreitzer, founder of StopImperialism.org, says Obama has scaled back tensions with Cuba while escalating Washington's war against Venezuela.
In other words, at the very same moment that the U.S. is unfreezing relations with Cuba, it is continuing to destabilize, to undermine, and to do whatever it can to destroy the independent socialist nation of Venezuela. So with all of that being said, we can see a confluence of crises globally and regionally that are really facing Venezuela, and the United States, to a large extent, is, if not behind all of them directly, then certainly manipulating them to a large degree. First and foremost, of course, is the ongoing resurgence, we might call it, of the right wing, that is the U.S.-backed political forces in Latin America. We see this in Venezuela with the elections of the December 2015, where the right wing reemerged as a dominant force in the National Assembly in Venezuela. But we also see the right wing in its ascendancy in Argentina, where President Macri won by a very slim margin. Macri, the U.S. puppet, right wing, neoliberal, pro-U.S., anti-Bolivarian president of Argentina. We see similarly in Brazil an assault against the government of Brazil, the government of Dilma Rousseff, former President Lula. All of these forces of the left are being undermined and destabilized and targeted by right-wing elements backed directly by the United States. Similarly, we see an ongoing destabilization in Ecuador of the Correa government. Now, what these places, these countries have in common is a common enemy in the United States, an alliance that was formed and forged by Hugo Chavez, the ALBA group, grouping, the SALAC grouping, a number of other regional multilateral institutions that were designed as counterweights, as bulwarks against U.S. imperialism, or what Chavez might have called Yankee imperialism. All of that is really the backdrop of what we're seeing with regard to U.S. Classifying Venezuela as a threat. Again, we also have to note that the U.S. is directly behind a number of the other destabilizing forces inside of Venezuela, including the artificially manufactured scarcity of goods, including the speculation against the currency, including the targeted assassinations such as that which killed the emerging leader Roberto Serra, such as that which killed Mr. Duran not too long ago, just a few months ago, a prominent journalist and prominent spokesperson for the government. These targeted assassinations and killings are taking place with the direct complicity of Colombian forces, Colombian paramilitary, and Colombian political leadership, who are all directly backed by the United States. We see this all over the region, and Venezuela is target number one. And then, of course, ultimately, we have to look at the collapse of global oil prices. The United States, of course, with its proxy in Saudi Arabia, with some of its other allies that have continued to overproduce while global oil prices have collapsed. No country anywhere in the world has been harder hit by the collapse of those prices than has Venezuela, which has lost almost 90% of its revenue for the nation. This has forced Venezuela into a corner. It is clearly and unmistakably destabilized the government, and that is, of course, something that needs to be understood as well. So all of these and many other forces, all of them tell us one cohesive and clear narrative, that the United States is directly targeting Venezuela because it sees in Venezuela a threat to its own regional hegemony. Venezuela as a close ally of Russia, as a close ally of Iran, as a close ally of China. Venezuela as essentially the gateway into Latin America for non-Western forces. Those who want to talk about a multipolar world understand the vital importance of Venezuela. So, too, is that understood in Washington. That's why they target Venezuela. That's why they want to destroy the Bolivarian government. That's why they want to roll back the gains of the revolution.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.